I love how I was thinking Glitch from like the Taylor Swift Midnight's Extended version. And you're like, this will be.
I mean, that's just, it has nothing to do with anything. It's just my vocal stem of the week.
Do you know what's so nuts is somebody posted like the next day, posted something about them getting married and the track was This Will Be. Or
no,
that song is. And I was like, oh my God.
Wait, that was a part of like their Instagram post?
Yeah, it was like a part of their reel.
Oh, God.
I know.
Making a damn reel about, please. And the song is, this will be an everlasting love. Who even sings that?
Oh, yeah,
that's
what it's called. It's called Everlasting Love. I think it's like something sisters. It's not the Pointer Sisters. It's like, I forget. But yeah, now it's following me everywhere.
That is peak millennial Gen X core to make a reel about your engagement. Get out of here. A boomerang, why not?
Truly.
Anywho, so it has been a minute since we've covered a story like this. And let me just tell you, because you don't exactly know what we're doing, but you know the type of story we're doing, this is going to be one for the books. This is going to be a lot for you to take in.
Baby, what survival story that we've covered hasn't been one for the books?
Truly, yeah. There's never a scenario where we pitch a survival story, we tell a survival story, and it's not like a 10 out of 10 full-blown narrative.
Yeah.
Like jaw-dropping reveals, shocking twists and turns. There is something in the story that you and I can't say that we will directly be able to relate to, but we can certainly feel the pressure and the pain of this one moment. But I'll get into that in a second. I mean, it's not going to be like a usual telling of this because I'm not even going to give you a top line. I can't really do that for this. I have to tell you the story moment by moment. It's one of those. But what I will say, if I could like boil this down into maybe one descriptive sentence of the story, it's two guys, friends, they head into the woods for a fishing/overnight camping trip. Another man emerges from the forest to join them. And that's what I'm going to leave it at.
Jesus. You're not even like giving me a landing pad. I'm just like skid marks on the ass.
Skid, baby. You want to rephrase that? you want to go back and try that again? Let's do the pickup.
I don't even want to retry. What am I trying to say?
I think you're right. I think those are two things that are right. It just has a double meaning when applied in the same sentence.
There's a double entendre. Yeah.
It marks.
I mean the actual skid marks on a road. But yeah, when you throw an ass in it, that's not a good segue.
It was just, what a setup. I was like, how do you feel about that? Skid marks on the ass. Full on shitting my pants.
God. Literally.
So before we get into it, I'll just do a really quick hello. Say hi to the creepers. Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to Creep Time, the podcast with Silas Dean and the lovely Miss Stew. Hi, everybody.
The lovely, delicate Miss Stew talking about skid marks. Lord,
the poised and painted lady, Miss Stew, and her
creepers.
Well, I'll keep this really short. I mean, I know we usually go through the usual. We say, make sure to follow and subscribe to the podcast. Make sure to leave a rating. If you feel positively about the show, you know how much that helps us out. You know, babies. But if you have not, I will say it again, please sign up for that newsletter. Not just because you can get the pre-sale codes to the Creep Time live show that is coming to Vegas this September, but also you will automatically be entered into any of the future giveaways for Creep Time, the podcast. So we don't want you to miss out. So pause this episode. Check down in the description for a link, or you can go to creeptime.com/giveaways and you can sign up for the newsletter. It takes less than 20 seconds, baby. But with that said, thank you again for all of the support for the show. Thank you for tuning in for a Friday episode to come hang out with us. And with that, Stu, are you prepared?
I'm gonna try to be as much as I can be for any survival story.
Well, how do you feel about the initial setup? Can I ask you? Just two guys, fishing trip slash overnight camping trip in the woods, a third party emerges from the forest.
I really don't mess around with like mountain folk coming out of the woodwork. I feel like we've covered that. There's one episode we've covered before where a girl was in the woods like running. Oh, it was like a Scary Stories from the Internet and somebody emerged from the woods. I do not mess with that. That really freaks me out.
When she runs away in the moaning in the distance. Yes.
Oh, God.
The open face palm. Hey. There's a lot of stuff going on right now. I was thinking about actually doing an Appalachian episode for Creep Time because there's so much stuff going on TikTok right now about different sightings and people talking about their stories, like don't look to the woods, don't stay out after dark. There was this video, maybe you saw this, maybe even saw it because I posted about it, but there was this guy and he works up in the mountains, like at a restaurant in near Appalachia, and he clocked in to work. He was like opening a restaurant. It's wicked early in the morning. It's like 5 a.m. crack of dawn. And while he's walking around the restaurant, kind of just ranting, like making a, you know, moment of thought TikTok, in the background, there's someone there. It looks like there's a person in that place, but it doesn't look like a normal person. And he didn't see anybody. I mean, he's clear as day, like walking through the main floor plan of this restaurant. And just in the background, right over his shoulder, is a fully formed face of what looks like a woman. Skid marks.
So creepy.
Skid marks.
No, that cannot become a thing. Please. You're
right. I'm shutting it down. I'm shutting it down. All right. Well, with that, let's get into the story. I'm going to jump right in. I'm first going to set the scene of these two men. Who were they? So we're going to focus in on one of two friends. We've got Scott Johnston and we've got Sean Farmer. These are kind of like, if I could give you a visual, actually, I can give you an actual visual. What am I saying? I've got a picture pulled up. Hold on. If I can give you a visual, I was going to say they're good old boys.
I got an idea.
Let's see. They're kind of like an Abbott and Costello. A few of those good old boys. They look like Abbott and Costello type, like that duo, because one is like very large and the other is pretty like short and thin.
Got it. Okay. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Wow. They look like you're... Okay. This is such a odd thing for me to think of, but they're like Southern Penn and Teller.
I don't know the reference. Wait, explain it.
Penn and Teller, like
explain it to the Northerners, including myself.
The magicians, Penn and Teller.
Okay,
same exact like height difference, body shape, except Southern, like that they're kind of in golf polos, golf shirts, and khakis.
I think I learned that in college about this is like a clowning archetype, like a clowning duo.
Yeah.
There's an actual name for it. I think it's French or something, but one describes like the large clown and one describes like the thin short clown. It's the same principle as like Abbott and Costello.
Yeah.
Same thing. So we've got these two guys, good friends, very, very routine for them. They would often go out on fishing trips, camping trips together. Not quite the Brokeback Mountain scenario I was hoping for, but this is May 6th, 2008. Longtime friends, very outdoorsy. So they would often go to this particular area. This was going to be an overnight fishing excursion by Dismal Creek, which is located in the rural part or a rural part of Virginia. But it would soon turn into something much more nefarious. So on this day, we're first going to focus in on Scott because he kind of kicked things off. He got there way earlier in the morning without Sean Farmer. So he's there to do like a solo, like fishing morning, very peaceful. He's expecting to be there alone because this is not like a heavily trafficked camping site or anything. It's not a family camping site is the way I can describe it. It's like deep up in the mountains. You would go there if you don't want to be disturbed. So he's assuming while he's fishing that morning, he's not going to see anybody by the water. Or so he thought. So Scott, he's hanging there, just waiting because Sean Farmer's going to pull up later. He's going to set up the campsite and everything. He's going to meet him later that night by the campsite. But before that happens, while Scott's at the water, he notices something across the way. There is another man seemingly hanging by the water who's also fishing. So he met this guy. And since the two of them, it's just the two of them there, he kind of like struck up a conversation because he was like, oh, he's like, it's a fellow fisherman. And it's kind of awkward. He's kind of a friendly guy and he wanted to go over and just smooth things out and introduce himself. The man goes by Ricky Williams. And Scott was just kind of passing the time with him, just trying to strike up that conversation. But he did get some initial strange vibes from this character. I'm going to refer to him as a character because that's exactly as he presents. Ricky Williams, he's kind of strangly and gaunt looking are Scott's exact words. His like official description of the guy. Very thin, looks kind of malnourished. He also looks kind of dirty, but he's relatively small in stature. So he's not very physically imposing. And I think Scott is like a pretty big guy. I get which one is which confused, but for whatever reason, he did not feel threatened by this man. That has to be like a rural country thing, though, that you would just go up to a stranger and start a conversation, because I could be anywhere. I could be 5 feet away from you, next to you on a plane. I won't open my mouth. There's nothing to be said.
Yeah, well, it's about being in the open. I mean, somewhere where people don't come a lot, that it's just weird to not acknowledge their presence.
That's true. Yeah. When it's just the two of you and there's literally nothing else around, it would be kind of eerie and creepy to not be like, hey, how you doing?
Right.
But I think what also kind of put this in this weird limbo state for him is like the guy looks weird and he's definitely very dirty. But again, this is like a camping area. So it looked like maybe he'd been out there for like a few days. But what kind of set the tone of normalcy is that the guy has on a really nice, expensive camo jacket. Like, it was a brand that Scott recognized. So Scott was immediately disarmed, because isn't that crazy, like, how quickly clothing can kind of reshift, like, your perception of somebody as, like, a person who's off and a person who's not?
Right. Or if it's, like, an article of clothing that's very legit in the fishing or hunting world.
Exactly.
I feel like it, like, lends a certain credibility to them being out there. So, like, your guard's going to go down.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, like he can be a dirty guy if he was camping, and he could be like a thin guy. Maybe that's just his frame. But if he's got on like a really nice camo jacket and brand new hunting boots, which he did, you're fine to think that this guy's normal. But clothing can be quite deceiving, as we would learn. So he also took note that this guy, Ricky, outside of the boots and the nice jacket, he had a dog with him, which again, I think also could disarm anybody, disarmed me. Like, I'm there to pet the dog, baby.
Sure.
Yeah, and it was a friendly dog, too. Like, not even, like, a hunting dog or anything. Like, he's just, like, his sidekick. So they hung out. They ended up catching quite a few fish. It was a great fishing day, and both of them really warmed up to each other. So much so to the point that Scott, feeling that this guy was really friendly and non-threatening, he invited a complete stranger to come join him and his friend Sean at dinner that night by the campsite. This would be a turning point in the story where things are going to shift massively. How are you feeling so far about this seemingly normal setup?
Do we know what time of day approximately they met? So
it was the morning.
Inviting them to dinner. Okay.
So Morning. It was early in the, because he started his day like fishing early that morning, early bird catches the worm kind of feel, but he had been hanging out with this guy all day and he seemed normal. Like he's carrying on a normal conversation.
Oh gosh. My first feeling, just knowing that this is going to take a turn, is that he must be wearing the clothing of someone else and perhaps has someone else's dog even with him.
Baby, how perceptive you are.
Oh God.
Ooh. So should I keep going? Should I keep pushing on?
I'm like, really... no, baby, let me tell you the whole story. I know these guys.
I was going to say, I was like, does she know this case? That's my dream, is for me to think I'm setting you up for a blind react. In the back of your mind, you're like, bitch.
And I'm like, oh, I grew up with him. He is from wherever in rural North Carolina. I have the whole thing already. I already know that. No.
I did feel like you would feel a connection to this. So you would at least like understand like the type of guys that we're working with here.
100%. I've been looking at the picture because I tend to do that whenever you start telling me the top line of the story. I just stare at the photo.
And well, I think that's your ESP kicking in. I think you look at photos. I think you're ESPN. You're looking at these photos and I think that you're taking in information. You're like downloading information.
Right. But I definitely know these types of fellows.
Oh, yeah. I look at the picture. I can hear a voice in my head. Yeah. I know how they sound. I know how they speak. Now, let's fast forward to the campsite. Later that evening. So it's dinner time. So the sun is pretty much going down at this point. Scott would show up to the campsite where Sean had already kind of set up a fire. He had the whole, you know, tents pitched and everything. And he showed up to introduce Ricky, the man who just seemed to appear from the woods with his dog. Now, what Sean immediately noticed, what he remembered, was just how thin Ricky and his dog were. He said at the time he didn't think much of it because you meet a lot of different characters, especially out in the woods, but he just thought that was very odd, like how shockingly thin the guy looked. But never mind, he got some food on the fire. He realized they wanted to hang out, they wanted to drink a bit, and they wanted to eat. So the men would sit there and they hung out over the course of several hours. They cooked food, they drank, they had lots of beers, they told stories and jokes. Like it was kind of odd, like how seamlessly Ricky seemed to just be blending into the conversation, and they were all having a really good time because he's a really super friendly guy. And he's actually drinking quite a bit more than them, which again, I kept trying to reframe this in my mind. I was like, that would disarm me too, because he's putting himself arguably at the disadvantage if he's getting drunker than the two guys that he's with, mm-hmm. right? Like, that's not a guy who's gonna have the upper hand on you.
Yeah, or it could be the opposite thing where it's somebody that has some sort of like addiction problem. And then like once they get way off the tracks, they get like a weird wind of like
something comes over them.
Yeah. Like superhuman kind of, not strength, but like, what's the right word? Like, no holds bar. Yeah. They get gall. They get like ballsy.
I think it was probably in conjunction with his size that made them feel comfortable, because he's considerably mm-hmm. thinner and, you know, shorter than they are. So they're like, nothing's going to happen here. This is fine. So like I said, they're hanging out by the fire, very relaxed. And then I think at a certain point, I should also mention, I don't want to get these mixed up, but you can obviously see from the visual which one is which. I think it was Sean. Sean is like 6'4 and 300 pounds. Mm-hmm. Like, he's a big guy. So he's not at all intimidated if something were to go awry. But at this point, they've spent the entire day together, so he's not assuming anything bad is going to happen. But I need you to brace yourself for what's going to come next in this story. Okay. So after a few hours, all these guys still hanging out. They're pretty drunk. It's gotten even more relaxed. Ricky gets up, almost like a social courtesy, kind of like he's like, all right, he's like, it's been great. I want to thank you for like inviting me out. This was so nice of you. It was great to meet you guys. And he kind of like whistles for his dog, which would signal to you, right? If you're sitting there, you're like, oh, he's probably like getting up to call tonight and like head out, right?
Yeah.
That's what they think. So they've got their backs pretty much turned to him while he's getting out and like, you know, getting his stuff together and getting the dog together. So he walks behind them and then kind of just says his goodbyes and walks away into the woods, like into the dark. So now at this point, Sean and Scott, they're just hanging by the fire, still drunk, thinking, oh, you know, that was great. You know, what a fun night. Great that we met somebody. The night's pretty much over. We're probably going to be heading to bed pretty soon. Ricky's gone in the woods and only a few moments went by. The next thing that Sean Farmer remembered was just the massive sound of something hitting and ringing in his ear. He shot up out of his chair and he was confused. He was like, what the hell was that? Stumbling, trying to figure out what just happened. What was that noise? But he realized that he had been hit by something. He had been shot in the head.
Oh my God.
Point blank range, shot right in the head. And in that moment, in the mix of this instantaneous panic, there is another loud sound. And then Scott ran off into the woods, Scott, his friend, without seeing anything. Like, he didn't see a gun. He didn't even know what happened. He was just like spooked by this sound. And by the time that he got to the darkness of the woods, he's like in the tree line, he realized that he had also been shot. He looked back towards the fire area, towards the campsite, where he saw the thin frame of Ricky, the man from the woods, standing there holding a .22 caliber gun. He had just fired a gun at both of them. Let's pause there, because we've taken a turn.
Oh my God. So Scott gets shot, but like kind of takes off. Like, I guess his wasn't as...
Oh, he didn't even realize he got shot.
Okay.
Didn't even know.
He just hears the gunshot and is like, he bolts. And then
he bolts.
Sean gets shot in the head and is just like basically stunned. And
he's standing. He's standing up.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Like, he got shot in the head and he was like, what the hell was that? And is standing up and is like stumbling around and has like blood gushing
oh my
from
God.
His head and his face. And Scott's in the woods, but Scott doesn't even realize the extent of his injuries at this point.
Yeah.
Because, yes, Scott was shot. We don't know how badly Scott was shot, actually.
So do you know how much time had, like, elapsed from the moment they were, like, Ricky leaves and then they're going to get ready to go to bed? Do you think it was, like, not even 5 minutes before
this
happened?
Was 20 seconds.
Oh, my God. Okay.
It was literally, like, the sequence of events was, thank you guys for such a great night. Whistles for the dog. Walks 10 feet away to the woods. Comes back with a gun. Shoots them both.
Oh, my God.
So this is where we're at. This is actually so much worse than they had originally thought because they were stunned from it. So they didn't actually realize either of them had been shot just yet. But when they do, and the shock is kind of wearing off and the moment is becoming a little more clear that they're in immediate danger, and this guy is now still standing there looking to finish the job, holding the gun. Sean Farmer, the big guy, he's been shot straight in the head. I think he also had a gunshot to his chest, shot twice. And then Scott, who's in the woods, he realized not only had he been shot in the neck, he was shot in the back. Two gunshots for him too. Gunshot wound, hole in his neck, gushing blood. So out of instinct, while he's in the woods, he took his index finger, crammed it in the bullet hole in his own neck to plug up the wound.
Mm-hmm.
And then he looked back and he saw Ricky Williams was walking towards him. He was coming into the woods in that direction. So Sean, despite literally a shot to the head and still being conscious, he actually makes a run for it to the pickup truck because Ricky's got his back turned. So he runs to his pickup truck, throws the keys in, and starts soaring down the road of the trail. Scott saw him and he's like, oh, if he's going, this is my one chance to get away. So with his finger plugged into his own neck, he starts running through the woods so he can try to meet him out by the trail and come out through like the brush, which he, I mean, the timing of it worked out almost perfectly because Scott starts sprinting, comes out from the woods, finger in the neck, comes out to the trail, and Sean sees him and he's like, oh, let me stop, opens the door and says, get in the truck. And they start speeding off because at this point, this man, Ricky, is still running through the woods trying to finish the job. And there's another truck that's still there because it's Scott's truck. Keys are in the ignition. Oh. So if he wants to get in the truck and race down, catch up to them, he's going to do so.
Oh my God. The keys were still in the ignition?
Yeah. They're in the middle of the woods. They would never imagine something like this was going to happen. They're totally disarmed.
God.
It's bad. I mean, the timing of it was lucky that Sean did see Scott and was able to get him in the truck because at least now they're in a vehicle together. But we're talking about two severely wounded men. And I have to paint you the picture, creepers. The woods they are in, this is not just like your standard forest. They're up in the mountains. When I was reading this, I was getting so sick, like thinking about this scenario of trying to get down a mountain in this way. They're 6 miles away from any known cabin or home. And then another 40 miles away from the closest hospital.
Oh, my God. Also, like those, just from this photo I'm looking at, I don't know if these were the exact woods they were in. But I mean, driving to get away from somebody quickly is not going to be an easy feat. Like you're going to be like whipping through trails and trees and thick brush. Like it's not going to be easy.
Oh, baby. It's so much worse than you think.
Oh, God.
It's even more challenging. The trail down the mountain from these woods, steep, high cliff drop-offs, no guardrails. Literally us like driving through the Rockies in that.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
That like imagine doing that, but having to race at like 50 miles per hour plus and doing it in the pitch black of night.
Oh,
no street lamps, nothing, just your headlights about like where the next twist and turn is coming from while you're both bleeding out.
Yeah. Plugging your own neck.
The floor of the truck, they said, was pooling with blood. Like just swashing at their feet from all the twists and turns of the road. So then at this point, Sean Farmer, who is the guy in the tree, he has the bullet in his head. He goes, Scott, I'm like losing feeling at my lower half. You've got to work the pedals. I'll steer. You got to work the pedals.
Oh my God.
So now they're simultaneously trying to. Did you hear that?
I was like, baby, I think there's a fairy.
It's Santa.
There's a fairy flying behind your head.
Oh, more noises around here. Damn.
Oh my God.
He's selling mangoes. I want to go out and buy one.
Wait, is that the ice or the produce guy?
It's so many people. I can't keep track of them. There's a person on a bike. This is a guy with a cart. There's the ice cream man. It's endless.
It's the creep time parade.
It really is. So where are we at? Blood is swashing at the pool of the truck. Sean, who's driving, his lower half is going numb. And the other guy has to at least keep his hand on his neck to stop the bleeding because he's going to lose consciousness otherwise. So what he does is he uses his lower half to keep his hands free to work the pedals while Sean is going to continue steering the truck down the mountain off the cliffside.
I can't.
It's like so insane and so improbable that you would survive this. It's like, how were you not panicking? How were you not freaking out? And at this point, they don't even know if that Ricky guy has gotten back to the other truck and he's soaring down there to catch up with them.
I was just going to ask you that. Like, I wanted to clarify if they knew the guy was still on the on their trail or because if it were me, I mean, God, I guess you just have to go because you really have no other option at that point. You got to go either because you need to get away from him or you need to go get help.
Well, you're going to bleed out. Really, I mean, you could hide out in the woods theoretically, but you're going to bleed out.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, a bullet hole in the head, like you don't have much time.
No.
I'm amazed he's even conscious at this point, conscious driving. Enough to drive. Mm-hmm. So by the time they do get down to the base of the mountain, meaning they had to weave for 6 miles down the mountain, they get to a whole row of houses, many of which have the lights off because you know how like mountain houses, like cabins, people aren't always occupying those. Like a lot of them are just left empty when it's off season or it's like a weeknight. It could be anything, but one of them, one did have the lights on. So they immediately went there and they started banging on the door. And originally the homeowner, she thought, oh my God, this is a home invasion because it's so unsuspecting. Like who would come banging on my cabin door in the middle of the night? And she's kind of panicking, but she quickly realizes she recognizes the voice, Sean's voice. It's her friend's ex-boyfriend. So she's like, oh my God, and opens the door and they're just covered in blood and barely conscious at this point. So she jumps into action. Her name's Melissa Miller because she was truly a savior here, saving the day. She gets on the phone, calls 911 and explains loosely from what Sean is telling her, the guy with the bullet hole in his head, what just happened. And she's holding towels to compress both of their wounds because they're bleeding out in real time. So dispatch, they had to send a helicopter out because don't forget 40 miles away from the nearest emergency room if they're going to rescue these guys. So by the time the helicopter comes to airlift them out, both men are pretty much completely unconscious. Like they're fading away. The blood loss has caught up to them. The adrenaline is not going to support them. And the cops, they now know that there's a guy who's still up in the mountains, who's on the loose. He's armed and he probably has a truck. So they start soaring up the mountain to try to look for the mystery man, look for this Ricky character who attempted to kill both of these hikers. While they're up there, what they realize is that they found the truck of Scott. So the guy did take the truck, but Ricky had crashed it down an embankment. Because don't forget, the guy's wasted.
Oh my God.
But he's alive, injured, down an embankment in a truck, but he's alive. Meanwhile, in the chopper, both these men, like I said, they're airlifted with the EMTs. They can't even speak at this point, but they're still somewhat conscious and aware of this. We kind of like talked about this with the Ellen Halbert story where like you can't speak, you can't even really move, but you're almost aware of like what's being said around you. What they do remember is hearing in the background from the EMTs, there's no pulse. Like these guys are gone. These guys are gone. Hearing that while you can't open your eyes, can't move your lips or speak. But
clearly having the will to live or wanting to live.
I mean, Jesus Christ. Like, you got to give him credit.
Yeah.
But miraculously, that was not going to be the end of their story, though, because they did get to the ER by helicopter. Both of the men were admitted to emergency surgery. Both are going to survive their attacks. In fact, I think Sean, his wounds, the wound to the head was so minimal, he's in recovery by the following morning.
That's so interesting. I was wondering this whole time, I was thinking like, where would the bullet have gone that he's, that it's in his head. I almost was thinking, like, did it graze, like, kind of like the back of his head or like towards his ear? Like, I was just trying to think of a area where it could have hit his head.
It got lodged. It got stuck in like the bone near his sinus cavity, which is what saved him. So the bullet itself was like stuck in his sinus cavity. So he definitely had like a severe wound to the face. Yeah. He was shot in the face pretty much, but it was stopped. And the other bullet, which was in his chest, he had, I mean, he's the bigger guy. So he had so much physical padding, so much body fat and so much muscle tissue that it stopped the bullet. It was inches away from his heart.
That's insane.
So lucky.
Lucky.
I mean, talk about a night. Like, Jesus Christ.
It's just insane how quickly it all turned. Like, I don't understand, or I don't know if we'll get to it, but like what this Ricky guy's motivation was to just like sit there, have a boys' night, and then all of a sudden go completely rogue. And have
it's a very like long, it's a long con, truly.
Yeah.
But it was not, I mean, completely randomized. It was somewhat premeditated, not to the point where he knew that he would run into these two guys, Scott and Sean, in the woods. But from the moment that he first met Sean earlier that morning, or Scott, I forget which one he met. From the moment he met him by the lake, he had plans to do this. And he was armed to do it. But we would also learn that Ricky is not quite so random of a character to these parts. There's actually quite a bit of evidence and proof that he had murdered before in these woods. You can't trust those woods, baby.
Maybe. There's a reason why you don't go to remote areas of the woods and go hunting or fishing or camping.
Well, I think this is technically, I mean, we're talking about Appalachia. I think this is technically near Appalachia.
Right. But I mean, there's places along Appalachia where you can go and it's a designated camping ground. Like, there's a reason not to go into the deep wooded areas.
Or if you see somebody, if you see somebody up there, be weary. Be weary about the characters that lurk up there full time alone.
Yeah, mountain folk are real.
So here's where we're at. Like I said, when police did go back up the mountain and they were looking for this Ricky character, they did find the truck. He was crashed at the bottom of the embankment. He does survive. They took him to the same damn hospital where these two guys were taken. They're all recovering. Isn't that ridiculous?
Oh my God. Like in the wing next door. Your murderer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Down the hall. Sharing a room. A curtain dividing you kind of vibe.
Oh my God.
So Sean Farmer, he's in recovery by the following morning. And I think the other Scott too. I mean, he would make a full recovery. And his wounds were not superficial. I mean, he was clearly shot in the neck and the back. But again, he's going to be able to make it out of that. They saw miraculous recoveries from it. And they wouldn't have any real long-term damage despite being shot at point-blank range. But let's talk a little bit about the character of Ricky. Because as they suspected, Sean said this. He said this when he first met the guy. He was like, he said his name was Ricky Williams, which I thought was like almost like a made-up name.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out it was. His real name was Randall Lee Smith. Actually, I've got a picture for you. Hold on.
Okay. Baby, again, the triple names.
It's a pattern we cannot refute.
Oh, God.
Let's see. I'll see if I can find a picture of him wearing glasses, too, to support your theory.
Okay. Describe and I have to say, this guy, if he looks like a typical hunter. I don't mean to, you know, with broad strokes here, say a typical hunter fisherman, but he does. Like, I can see, if you look at a picture of Scott and Sean, you could see Ricky kind of standing next to them and be like, those three guys are friends and they go hunting and fishing together.
Totally. There's nothing about him that screams overtly threatening or any more threatening than if I were to see Scott and Sean in the woods.
Yeah.
I mean, his hair looks coiffed. He's got a beard, but it looks, I mean, nothing about him reads as like, oh, that's a character who's unstable.
Yeah, no, it just kind of reads like your typical fisherman, sort of.
Actually, I think I have another picture of him. Let me see if I can find this. I think this is him when he was like really young, though. Okay. Let's see. Sean Farmer, Ricky. Let's see.
So
was this at all what you expected? His real name is Randall.
Randall. Okay.
Yeah. okay, I've got this.
Did not think he was going to look like this. I really thought that he was going to look like much more. And again, I'm sure that this photo is not as malnourished as he looked to Sean when he was gaunt.
But imagine this, like, gaunt and like kind of roughed up, like a little dirty.
Yeah, he has very long eyelashes.
Yeah, he really does. Did you look at the picture of him when he was younger?
Yeah, yeah. And but in both, that was the first thing I noticed in the first photo you sent me. I was like, wow, he has really long eyelashes. And then same.
Does that make a difference for you?
I don't know. I guess, you know what it was? It was surprising to see somebody that's supposedly so scraggly and like, you know, has deviant nature to have such bright looking eyes.
Right. And to realize that they're a common user of the hit brand Latisse to grow their lashes. Yeah.
Falsies, maybe.
Falsies, right. Snips. So that's him. But let me get a little bit back. I mean, once they realized who he was and police are able to connect the dots, they uncovered some really sinister history that the guy is not as random as we would think. He's not just a mountain man. And this was his first kill. Back in 1981, Smith, he had killed two other hikers in the same exact area. And they had actually given him a moniker, the Appalachian Trail Killer, which is a totally separate case. He was found guilty for this. He pled guilty to it. It was two counts of second-degree murder, and that was back in 1981. It was for the killing of Laura Susan Ramsey as well as Robert Mountford Jr. He shot them. He then bludgeoned them after they were shot and disarmed, and then stabbed them before he wrapped them up in their own sleeping bags and buried them. He was caught.
Oh, my God.
But the craziest part is, like, he was caught and he was tried for that. And then by 1996, he reached parole and he went right back to the same campground. He like lived up in those mountains.
So he's out for the kill. It's not for anything else. He enjoys a kill.
I mean, there's a lot of suspicion, although they couldn't find any substantial evidence. And even Sean Farmer has made comment of this today. He's like, I would be shocked if those were the only two people that he killed.
Yeah.
I think that he is, over the course of like his freedom from 1996 all the way up until this event, which was 2008, it's more than likely that there were other bodies. We just don't know where those bodies are. Now, here's the real kicker, which is going to kill you. So don't forget, he crashed this truck down an embankment because he was wasted and they recovered him. He had injuries, but he was in recovery. He survived. 4 days after his arrest, Smith dies of natural causes in the hospital.
Oh my God.
Are you kidding me? Like, are you joking?
I mean, I don't wish like any, I don't have a death wish for somebody, but I certainly don't mind that it's somebody that was out killing people. I mean, good Lord. It's
the irony of like a peaceful death in your sleep of natural causes. He was 54, by the way, too. Peaceful death.
Oh. But he didn't have any injuries from the car crash?
I think he had injuries, but I don't think he had any injuries that were life-threatening. Like, none of his death was not the result of his car crash.
Okay. I just wasn't sure if, like, he was in the hospital because of his car crash injuries and then, you know, like, died in his sleep.
I mean, those two things are true. He was in the hospital recovering from the physical injuries, but those injuries were not life-threatening. And then, like, his heart just gave out on day four.
Well, I'm sure he also gave out. I'm sure he was like, all right, this is my second time getting caught. I'm over this.
Death by embarrassment? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, death by having a mental illness to begin with and thinking to himself, I'm not going back to jail. I bet you anything that was a real thought that came across his mind.
That is a real thing. I remember other cases that I've looked at that are kind of similar with like people who get caught for horrific crimes. And there's something about like the shock of getting caught and like knowing what your future holds that people just drop dead. Mm-hmm. Like I was thinking of Blanche Monnier when her mother got caught after keeping her daughter in confinement for like 25 years. She died of a heart attack in prison in like 2 days.
Yeah, I think that's totally a true thing because I think that for a lot of these people, it's the freedom to be able to commit their heinous crimes that gives them a thrill, gives them a purpose. And when they're in confinement, the thought of being confined and not being able to act on any of it is a fate worse than their own death.
You know what was really bugging me about it? I agree with you, but I never saw anything in the research that gave me a recap on what happened to the dog.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Wait, did we ever get to, like, was that his dog?
I think it was, this is part of the reason they suspected, like, the camo gear and stuff came from another victim, maybe just an unnamed victim, mm-hmm. because that came from somewhere, and he definitely didn't get it himself. Mm. You hear it? Wait. He's here.
It's an ice cream truck.
He's here. It's a horror movie.
It really is.
Like, middle of the
is.
Night, like, bum, 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 but, like, it's, there's something scary about him.
Someday we really do have to get him on an episode.
Maybe he doesn't want it. He doesn't want the heat. He wants to remain anonymous and elusive always. But so back to the dog. Sorry. I don't know if they ever found out where the dog came from, but it's suspected that it was somebody else's dog that he just stole. But he definitely stole those boots and he stole the camo jacket for sure off somebody. It's just a question of, like, okay, well, how did he get those things? Can we assume that he might have buried another body up there?
Yeah.
So he's dead. That is kind of closing any window to the case if they were going to find out if there were other bodies up there. But nonetheless, they did go back up the mountain, police, to do a sweep of the grounds. They never found any evidence, like substantial evidence to say, like, oh, there are other bodies out here. There were other murders. But they did find a really dark collection of Smith's items, things that he had in his possession, stuff that chilled police. Like, he had something like 30 different knives that he was keeping. He also kept, I found this interesting. You would find it interesting too, I think. He kept his birth certificate and he kept his GED, both documents.
Well, I'm sure he had that in case somebody questioned him, like, what are you doing here? He had some sort of identification on him.
Oh, I guess that makes sense. Yeah. Me thinking, I'm like, maybe there was a part of him that wanted to hold on to the possibility of, I'm building a narrative in my mind. Skid marks,
like, maybe
baby.
He really,
skid marks.
Maybe he really did want to go after that physics degree.
Maybe. I mean, a bachelor's, it's just a few night classes away.
Right, right.
There were some darker elements of, you know, the things that he had up there. They also found a series of cassette tapes that looked like, I mean, they couldn't confirm, but they sounded like satanic rituals, like they were chants.
Oh.
On these tapes.
Oh.
He goes, hell yeah, bitch.
He goes, satanic.
Satanic. It is satanic.
I just can't get over that damn horn.
It's crazy. He is ripping down the street right
ripping,
now.
Ripping, flying 80 miles an hour.
Kids playing at the street, mowed down, flattened. God. Like, he has places to be. Oh, the thing is, God. I never even see him stop. He never, like, nobody ever buys the ice cream.
Baby, I never hear him stop.
Yeah, you never hear, like, the squeak of the brakes?
No, I just hear, bah, 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 bah. They're gone.
Yeah, it's an intimidation into tactic, for sure.
Yeah.
He's out into the distance. So that's really where we're left, though. I mean, we're stuck with this strange man and a story that feels unfinished. But despite this harrowing affair, both of these men, Sean and Scott, they do miraculously recover from their story. And they would return to the area to take routine fishing trips up at Dismal Creek, even to this day. That's now, a country boy for you.
Let me tell you something. I was going to say, that is a Southern duo for you.
To be They're shot like, in the head and the neck and be like, well, I mean, fish are still there and the guy's dead. Like,
Southern stoicism of it all. Oh my Lord. That is pretty nuts? Funny. That is pretty funny. That's actually kind of badass.
A little bit. I was like, stupid, not a shred of PSD.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, listen, at least now they know to be up there and be armed. Keep your wits about you.
Sure.
You would think that it would trigger something to be like hanging at the same campground to be like, remember when we got shot in the f-ing head by this fire a few years ago?
They're like, yeah, man, that was crazy.
Literally, like that's how I imagine the conversation going. Yeah. It's like crazy shit out in these woods. Yeah, you were shot in the neck. It's like, it's so nuts to me.
It's like the ending of like a Quentin Tarantino movie or something.
Yeah, how would you ever be able to sleep? Like, how could you rest in your tent that night and like not pay attention to every like stick snap in the woods?
Right. I am so curious about was it Randall?
Yeah, Randall.
Randall. I
hear like my voice. Gotta go. Yeah.
Yeah. this is where Foghorn Leghorn starts to take over, that we get into like full on like we become cartoon characters. I would be so curious like how he kind of like got up there, or like after, like did it's so fascinating to me anytime characters like Randall come out of jail for committing such a heinous crime and then I'm sure assimilate back into society for like a split second, and then like how long it takes them to decide, okay, I actually want to return to that part of myself that likes, you know, doing those things, and like how am I going to do that? What's my new identity? Who are my new victims? Like, I would be really curious to know more about like his backstory, like especially like after like the first murders that he ever committed, and then when he came out of that, like how he ended up in these woods. Why?
I mean, that was a big story even back in the day in 81. So, I mean, I know a lot of time had passed. Like, you would never assume like 20 years after the fact, I mean, more than 20 years, that these woods were unsafe because a murder took place there. I mean, you would assume, I would assume, I'm like, well, a double murder with a shooting, bludgeoning, and then stabbing. Yeah, that's somebody who's put away for life. Mm-hmm. Not the case. Out in about 15 years on parole. So I don't think that they were cognizant, Sean and Scott, that they were in dangerous territory. One, because they were familiar with the place, they had camped up there before. But two, I mean, all of the disarming elements of Ricky, or Randall, I guess I should call him. I almost wonder if there's a psychological connection. And of course, the mental health counselors, all the mental health professionals who listen, they're going to clock us on this too. But I do wonder, when I read some of these cases, about the psychological connection for the killer based on environment. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes if they return to a place where something bad had gone down for them years prior, they re-enter that headspace. It's like there's a psychology theory about people who return to their childhood homes, no matter how much progress in theory they've made with their mental health, with the way they've been able to sort out their lives and managing their emotions and their emotional stress, returning to that environment of a stressful childhood home, you instantly revert back to the patterns of how you were able to survive that years and years ago. Yeah. I think it's the same thing here, the same principle.
Is the photo you sent me of him young, is that his mugshot from his first killing? Or is that
I think
just
so.
Okay.
Yeah. He was pretty young.
Wow. Yeah, he's very young.
I mean, I'm sure there's much more to his story. We could do a whole case on the Appalachian Trail killer for sure, but there's so much more backstory. This is just kind of a top line of the survival of Scott. I just can't stop imagining like them returning and having their good old boy conversation over some beers.
Crazy. It's kind of great.
It makes me feel better about the horror of the story. It makes me feel a lot better that it didn't stifle like what they love to do. They love to camp and hang out together. One of them didn't have to lose a friend. And I'm sure they're much more bonded because they're like, shit, man, we got shot.
How did we do that?
We got shot and then we like dually drove a car down a mountain.
It's insane.
I don't know. Nothing to make of it. I am curious, though, if anyone has done a deeper dive. I know that the police did their sweep in 2008 up in those mountains, but I'd be willing to bet some money that there could be bodies up there. I really don't think these are the only people in Randall's grip.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like to be that young and to want to go and do that and just like live out in the woods. I mean, I would imagine he was young and snappy and fit enough to be able to like execute on more than just those victims that ended up getting him caught.
Yeah. I mean, he had tact. Like, he wasn't a complete fool, but I mean, he was drunk for a lot of this. So he was definitely an alcoholic, but he knew how to fish. He knew how to hunt. I think he knew how to be self-sufficient up there and sustain. Yeah. It's just a question of like how many people crossed paths with him and then were never seen and nobody ever reported them missing.
So weird to think about, because this photo, I'm sure, is like from the 70s, the earlier one. Thinking about, I don't know why this is playing in my mind, but like a side by side almost of like him in the 70s, him in the 2000s about to like commit the same type of crime. Like, I wonder how he interacted with those victims, like if it was the same kind of chummy setup. And then
that's a good point. Yeah. How much of that was like curious. Pre-planned?
Yeah.
It almost seemed like he was just kind of going with the flow a little bit. It seemed like it didn't seem as premeditated, or I didn't want to assume he was smart enough to premeditate any of that, because who's to say, like, he doesn't know when these guys are coming up, and who's to even say that this guy wasn't just coming up alone? He had no idea that there would be another person or a campsite nearby, or that he would be invited into the conversation or invited over for dinner. So it just seems oddly opportunistic in that way, which is maybe what prolonged the actual shooting, that he was like sitting there just kind of enjoying himself, maybe actually enjoying a little bit of the contact, but then realizing, oh yeah, I came here to do something.
That's so strange.
What was the game plan after that? Like, what was he, for what reason? I'm trying to understand. I mean, I know the motives are always sick, but I'm like, is it just for the thrill of the kill? Do you want their belongings? Do you want their money? What do you want?
I mean, I guess it sounds like from the first thing, it's more this weird, to be honest, like a parallel of being a hunter and fisher, like the stalking of the prey sort of out in the woods, and then to be, you know, befriending it or them. And then all of a sudden, the thrill of the kill, the thrill of finally capturing them.
Isn't there something to the sport of hunting? People talk about like the challenge of getting within close range. If you think of this from a really twisted perspective, that is sort of what he was doing.
Yeah.
That's so dark.
Oh, God.
Would you ever hunt? Are you a hunter?
You know, it's weird. Like, I grew up going our farmhouse out in Virginia. Like, there was a hunter's, like, stand out in the middle, which I thought was so eerie. Just like that, you know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. Just like out in the middle of a field. I just
Were you like perch your elbows if you're gonna like do target practice kind of thing?
No, I mean like literally, like imagine like a little hut that's like up like 12 feet up in the air.
Oh, that you're firing at?
Yeah. So you go up in the stand and then you stalk your prey. You like look out of the hut and you like figure out.
Oh, that's even darker than what I thought. That's so much darker.
Yeah. I mean, and the reason why we had it is because it was a farm. So you'd get up in the stand and you'd shoot, you know, animals that were going to come and eat your animals, you know,
keeping night watch.
Right. But I don't know. I've never understood, you know, I grew up with a lot of people that were obsessed with hunting and fishing. And I think for most people, it's a big bonding experience with the person that teaches them how to do it, because there is a lot of skill required, of course.
Yeah.
But yeah, hunting to me, I don't want to take the life of something that's living innocently out in the world, but to each their own. A lot of the times, the things that you're allowed to hunt are overpopulated, which is why it's illegal. But yeah, I never quite understood that.
I grew up fishing a lot with my dad, so
yeah,
that I guess that was, as a northerner, I was like, that was our hunting. Fishing.
Yeah, no, that, I mean, yeah, totally, they go together.
Yeah, I mean, we used to go to now you have to have like, I mean, I don't remember ever, like, I guess I was young, so I didn't know this, but I don't remember ever having like permits or anything like that, or having to like do any certifications. Like, I was just taken to like fish. But everything that we would catch, it was either like a tossback, or it was something, it was big enough and it was a good fish, we were going to take it home to like prep it. So there was always like a reason behind it. That's like what I was taught. It was like, you're either fishing to toss it back immediately, like you don't just keep a fish to kill a fish, or you're going to take it home and you're gonna have dinner.
Yeah.
But hunting was something very, very far away from like anything I would have been involved in. I think mostly because my family had a very strong aversion to guns. So anything even remotely close to that was just too scary, like too much potential for something to go wrong in the woods.
Yeah. Yeah. So was my family. Same way. Yeah.
And I also don't like the idea. It would be really tough for me to kill an animal. A fish is a little bit different. I know a fish is an animal. Don't come for me, creepers. Don't do it. But the thought of me shooting a deer or something, I don't know if I could do that.
Okay, this is a deep cut, but you know what? I've been staring at Randall's photo this whole time. Mm-hmm. Do you know who he's reminding me of? And of course, the hunter element is reminding me of this. Remember in Jumanji, there's the hunter character?
Yeah, but he doesn't look like this, does he?
I mean, he sort of looks like, the
safari hunter with the mustache?
Yeah, I mean, look at that guy. He kind of has the same vibe.
Baby, hold on. Creepers, I will confirm or deny. Oh, maybe actually, hold on. Yeah, it's something about those weird, the eyes.
The eyes and the kind of pointed, the pointed nose, but really it's the mm-hmm. mustache and the beard for me. But what I'm thinking is more along the lines of like the hunter in Jumanji was like hunting people.
Yeah. Jumanji's a sick movie, I gotta say. Like,
oh
it's,
my God,
it's
it really is.
A little dark, a little twisted, but like what a sick concept.
Oh, it's so good.
Also, this is random, but now that I'm looking at his mustache and beard, do you like a beard? Fan of a beard?
You know I like scruff.
You do? Okay, but what about when it becomes old man scruff and you see how the stuff close to the mouth is like discolored? I don't like that.
Oh, no.
I don't, I'm not into that. I don't need to see a man with a white beard who looks like he's been chowing on some tomato basil soup.
Baby, I only like scruff if it's not on a serial killer.
Well, duh. I'm like, well, of course. I don't know how I feel about scruff these days. I don't know.
I've always liked scruff.
Good. Well, you hear that? It's set in stone, creepers. Sue's into the scruff, if anyone's listening.
But not on this man. Certainly not on this man.
I know. You know what's strange is that I mean, I know that we always say like we see a lot of serial killers who wear glasses. Obviously, Randall does not fit that profile, but I actually can't remember, and I don't really know what the ratio is in my mind of serial killers that we've looked at who have facial hair and the ones who don't.
I'm trying to think.
You know what's weird to say is that on this podcast, despite having like 80 plus episodes, we actually haven't covered a lot of cases with like a known serial killer because we cover so many disappearances and like unsolved cases, cold cases. It is kind of rare that we have an actual visual of a suspect.
Yeah, I feel like I'm trying to even think of who we have.
Let me think. Well, I mean, if I think of the survival stories, we always end up having a picture of those people. So Ellen Halbert, he was 18, so he had no facial hair. He was a baby.
Oh, Brian Koberger, of course, is like the first one that pops into my mind.
Oh, yeah. Also, I mean, no facial hair.
You know what? I feel like they tend to actually be the younger serial killers that, like, I'm even thinking about, like, Dahmer or, like, Night Stalker.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like they were, like, relatively, like, clean cut, sort of.
They really were, yeah. Maybe there's a polar opposite to each side of the spectrum. It's, like, when they're younger and they're a little more, like, virile and, like, agile, they're just, like, very clean cut. Very careful. And then as they get older, that's when they start to become like scraggly, kind of decrepit.
Yeah. Well, I think the clean cut nature helps them blend in for a long time, too.
I mean, it could just be a practicality thing of like survival.
Yeah.
And then as they kind of, you know the name of the game and they're pushed out further and further to the fringes of society, they don't really have to keep up appearances. In fact, they're probably so isolated that no one's really seeing them.
I actually would be really curious if there is a vanity element to psychopaths. Like, because I just think about, I don't know why I'm going off on a tangent here, but like when you think about.
Girl,
like,
go. No one's going to stop you. You think the creepers are going to say, hush it up, girl.
They're like, and cut off. When I think about like American Psycho or something, it does kind of paint this like satirical representation of like a killer, like a handsome killer. And it's just weird to think that that's this like archetype in killer, like serial killer lore, is that they tend to get like idolized for their look sometimes. And I do wonder though, because you do see that as a pattern with a lot of psychopaths and psychopath killers, that they do tend to look like they care about their appearance. And I think
you're
that would correlate in my mind. It would make sense that like psychopaths would have some sort of vanity element.
I wonder if it's just, is it like textbook narcissism or, I mean, like you said before, is it a survival instinct to try to blend in, to try to assimilate and keep people off your trail? Or is it, I mean, I would assume most people who fall into this kind of thinking, who become serial killers, they struggle a lot with detachment. Like they feel like they can't attach themselves to relationships with other people. So maybe they start to foster the relationship they have with themselves more than the average person.
That sounds really astute to me. That sounds like it's on the money.
Well, I am teaching a lecture in forensics at the University of...
Baby. Oh,
they would sign my check. They would say, and how do you spell that name? Is it H-A-C-K?
All I'm imagining is you starting the lecture in like a 450-person lecture hall just busting through the doors being like, he is a crackpot.
No, shut it down. It's even more theatrical. She's sitting in the back row, shades on, cap on, blending in with the lecture. And then in the middle of it, she goes, and what do you have to say about this, Mr. Dean?
Not Mr. Dean.
Mr. Dean. Dean, Jimmy. I keep doing a vocal stim with her. I can't stop thinking about, and I don't think I've ever heard her say these exact words. But she gets so vicious sometimes on the show when she's interrogating somebody who she thinks is guilty that I imagine her going, what do you know?
Okay, baby, you know what you just did.
What did I do?
You basically just did the same thing, but with, what do you know?
Well, I can't scream that. I'm going to blow out the mic. But I love the, I mean, that sounds like a fever dream, like a stress dream I would endure. I'm teaching a lecture at a college on forensics and I'm heavily ill-equipped to do so. And Nancy Grace just starts slow clapping and goes, very impressive for a hack, bitch.
Very impressive, Mr. Dean. I love Mr. Dean.
Where are you in the mix of this dream? Are you the TA? Like, are you in the lecture hall? What's happening?
I think I'm cracking open a cold one with the boys.
Okay, yeah, you're off with the boys in the woods.
I'm over at the frat house.
No. Delta, Delta, Delta.
Oh God. Baby.
Okay. Baby. Listen, I can't be held accountable for anything that you've said on previous episodes.
I know. My God.
But with that, maybe this is a good place that we can wrap things up. I feel like that went by pretty quick, but kind of like a flash of a survival story, like a really like hard hit.
I feel like the survival stories always go by very fast, just for me as a listener. I don't know if you feel that way as telling me as a storyteller, but...
Well, you're on the ride.
I'm on the ride.
You're watching a movie.
Yeah, truly.
It truly is like one of the most incredible stories. I had heard it a while before because this was actually one of the episodes on the show I Survived. I think it's episode 125. But and I love that show. It's for anybody who hasn't watched I Survived. It's incredible. You'll never be in short supply of the most miraculous survival stories. But there's something really satisfying every time that we cover one. And of course, it has to be because they survive in the end. But it gives a different tone to the cases we cover because these tend to have a lot of closure.
Right. And it's also that sometimes like when we leave our cases, we know that the victim was like obviously like brutalized or mutilated or never found or like you're saying, there's no closure. So it's nice to know that there's people that get into these predicaments that it's like a win for us too, that they get out safely.
Yeah. It gives you a glimmer of hope, I think, to everybody who's listening, because that's part of the reason you do listen is the feeling of like something bad can happen, but I want to know that I've got a fighting chance in it. And these guys really fought to live.
Totally.
Well, Bybee, I want to thank you for such an enjoyable episode of Creep Time, the podcast. Creepers, thank you for sticking around and listening to this one, because I know that you eat these survival stories up. So we appreciate you hanging around with us on a Friday. But for now, we're going to catch you on the next one and we will say goodbye.
And good luck.
Salutations, y'all.
Salutations, creepers.
What do you know?
This will be.